This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2. You'll find us online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. So glad to have you with us this afternoon. Today we're going to explore the relationships between young and old social mammals and birds. How does aging affect their lives and their behaviors? How are older animals viewed by others within their group? Do the ways aging affects social animals, non-human social animals, parallel ours as humans? Those are some of the questions we'll take up this afternoon. Our guest is animal behaviorist Ann Innes Dagg, the author of The Social Behavior of Older Animals. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. We look forward to your telephone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Our guest, Ann Innes Dagg, teaches in the Independent Studies Program of the University of Waterloo, Ontario. She's the author of more than a dozen books, including Love of Shopping is Not a Gene, Problems with Darwinian Psychology. Her book, The Social Behavior of Older Animals, is published by the Johns Hopkins Press. Again, our phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Ann Dagg, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon.
Oh, hi.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good. This apparently is an area of scholarship, social behavior of older animals, that's wide open. You report most behavioral research on wild animals does not look at older animals. Why has this been so?
I guess the main reason is that it's impossible to tell an animal is old in the wild pretty well. It could have wrinkles, it could have white hair, but very often it looks very much like its peers. And therefore, it's hard to make generalizations about them.
Mm.
This is, I think, what's prevented other people from studying it. But so it is a wide open field, and I was really lucky to get into it.
Yeah, yeah. It's such an interesting field to me as a layperson. I would, you know, I'm very curious about this. I would think that there would be students in colleges that would be very interested in this topic across disciplines too.
Yeah. I've been asked to speak at an anthropology department and a biology department, so that's good. It's it'll help make the whole issue more public.
Yeah. Does the aging process in animals mirror our own as humans?
Sorry?
Does the aging process in social animals mirror...
Oh, mirror, yes.
Yeah, mirror that of us as humans?
In a way, yes, in part, but each animal, or each species actually, is often different from every other species. So, although in the book, when I did sent the manuscript in, they wanted me to put in more human comparisons, which I did. I found that it was hard to compare all of them.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there are differences between species, certainly. But maybe here at the outset, you could talk a little bit about the length of lives of animals in the wild.
Okay. And again, they vary absolutely hugely. The large animals tend to live the longest. Elephants, maybe 60 to 70 years. Sperm whales, maybe 80 years. They're not sure because they haven't ever got one that old. Small animals like shoes might live for 2 years. And it's interesting, if you look at the blood heartbeat of each of these animals, the shoe could be as much as 1,300 beats per minute, whereas the elephant, it's about 25 beats per minute. So we can really think of each animal really having the same sort of metabolism. At the long run, they maybe have had so many heartbeats to make up their lifetime. But then there are a lot of variations as well. because the bats are very small, the hibernating bats, and they have a much longer lifespan than the shrew, although they're about the same size, and that is because they hibernate. So that's some of the variation. Is that what you wanted to know?
Yeah. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what a shrew is.
A shrew.
A shrew. Oh, a shrew.
I'm speaking Canadian. That's a problem.
That's not a problem at all. I'm glad, though, I asked because I thought, ooh, I've never heard of a shrew. I mean, I'll take them off my feet, of course. But
a shrew that's
a shrew.
So tiny.
Yeah, a shrew. Okay.
Yes, they're very small, probably smaller than most mice.
Yeah. I think one of the most interesting chapters in the book involves elephants and what happens to young elephants when they don't have older elephants looking after them. Would you tell us the story of the problem seen in a game reserve in South Africa in the 80s and 90s?
Yes, that was terrible. We tend to think of elephants as a species that's going to be exterminated, but actually in some countries there are far too many of them. And in the 90s, in the Kruger National Park, there was a huge, they were ruining the environment, really, because there just were so many adults. So what they decided to do was to kill a lot of adults, and then they came with a helicopter and shot them. And the young animals, of course, saw this and were completely traumatized. Then they gathered up these young animals, put them in trucks, and shipped them to reserves and parks in South Africa, which didn't have elephants. And this seemed like an ideal solution, so these animals would grow up and then these parks would have an elephant population. But when they grew up to be about 20, when their testosterone came in, they became able to breed and adults, they became completely uncontrollable, the males. And actually it managed to kill 19 rhinos in one of the parks because they ran completely amok. And the reason is that they weren't brought up with their mothers who cultivate them and teach them what elephant behavior is. Then when they get to be 14, they leave the herd and the male elephants take them over and then teach them what it is to be a male elephant in part. They're more casual though. And of course these youngsters had missed all that and therefore were completely unable to cope with their culture.
Yeah.
And one actually killed a human being who came to try and shoot them. So it was really a catastrophe, which we hadn't thought about at all.
Yeah, another reason for studying the social behavior of older animals.
Exactly.
How do elephants guide their young? What are the roles of mature males and females in raising the young?
Well, the males actually aren't there at all with the young. They come in to breed with a female who's an estrus, but when the females are just within their own herd, the males are somewhere else. So it's the female elephants, the matriarch particularly, who raises the young. She'll make sure that each young keeps its place. If it gets out of place or is doing something she doesn't want to do, she'll give it a swat. If it goes bathing, for example, and looks as if it might drown, she'll lift it up. If the troop is moving through a landscape and they're going too fast, perhaps she'll slow it down so that the smallest animals will be able to keep up with the herd. They're amazing. They're just amazingly wonderful animals, the matriarchs. And on one occasion, there was a baby elephant was killed by lions, and a person writing a book wrote that there were 100 elephants then were led by an old matriarch in a single file up past the young elephant. They all in turn stood to look at the elephant for a few minutes and then moved on until all 100 had come and paid tribute, in memory of this poor little elephant, and then they moved off again, which is amazing behavior when you think about it.
Yeah. Boy, what does that tell us about the emotional lives of elephants and other animals?
Oh, yes.
I was struck by how much teamwork goes into raising the young in an elephant herd, because female elephants may bear young into their 60s, and so they've got to help one another.
Well, that's right. If you were an older matriarch, you could have a tiny baby. You could have one that was 4 years old. You could have one that was, say, 10. And you'd have these three to look after as well as your whole herd, which might be, say, 30 elephants. So she really is remarkable, and that means that the other elephants then gather around and help her raise the young, her young, which is great. And they all look after each other's young, although they don't suckle them. but they keep an eye out for all the young in the tribe, sort of like a village raising a young elephant instead of a person.
This gets us to a very interesting question. Are social non-human animals teachers?
There's a lot of dispute about that. Most people think they're not, but I actually think they may be in certain cases. And the best case I've read about, I just read about a few examples, but one was a red fox who lived near Oxford in England. And a man was studying them called McDonald, Dr. McDonald, and he was using a night television scope, and he saw the mother collecting worms in her jaw and then pulling them slowly out of the earth and then eating them. And she was 9 years old. She had only one tooth. She was called Toothy Peg. And her youngster came over to watch, and because he wasn't having any success catching young. As soon as he tried to grab them, they'd all disappear into their holes. But she held it taut for him, and he gradually got to understand that he could take over from her and learned how to do it within a month, which is great.
Yeah.
So it seemed to me that was teaching.
Yeah, I think I guess it depends what you mean by the word teaching or the activity teaching. But some years ago, one of my brothers told me, and he used the word taught. He had two cattle dogs.
Oh, yeah.
And he had a fenced-in yard, big fenced-in yard. And he said one of these dogs taught the other one how to climb this chain-link fence.
But again, the people that don't believe in teaching would say, oh, well, that's just sort of coincidence.
Yeah.
And teaching, they think, is something that you have to know you're doing and that you know you're smarter than the individual you're trying to teach. But in reality, I don't think that's important, really. If it gives the other animal an advantage in life, surely that's enough in a definition of teaching.
Well, how much do we learn by example, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Are anecdotes from people regarding their companion animals useful to animal behaviorists?
Well, in this case, yes. I used a whole lot of them, actually, because they're just so little in the literature. So I really read a lot of books, a lot of articles, a lot of magazines, and gathered up information that way, as well as looking at everything that I could find in the literature, in the scientific literature, about old age and behavior and things like that.
Yeah. Do you think animal behaviorists as a group, and here we're generalizing, of course, and perhaps unfairly, but do you think that they are less likely or unlikely to value those kinds of stories?
Probably, but if that's all we got, it's better than
nothing,
I think, anyway.
Yeah. Well, here's a story from my own backyard. We have a couple of bird feeders in the yard, and they have some pretty nice baffles on them to keep the squirrels away. And for years and years and years, they worked just fine. And recently, we have had a squirrel, smarter than the average squirrel, who figured out how to get up there. And it seems to me that others have followed his or her example. So,
which makes the point right there.
Yeah.
But the others would argue that imitation isn't really teaching. But I think it's a semantic thing, really.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Anne Innes Dagg. She's the author, most recently, of The Social Behavior of Older Animals. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, stories about animals. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Back to the elephants, maybe you would talk with us a bit about how they care for one another when they have ill or wounded animals among them. Okay, I'm sorry. I think maybe our guest had a tickle or something and went looking for a little sip of water. So here we go again. I'll rephrase the question, or I'll ask the question again. Back to the elephants and their care for one another. How do they care for one another? Do they care for one another if they have ill or wounded among them?
Well, in one case, there was a hunter shot a big male, and I'm not, yeah, maybe just the big male. And then he looked through his microscope and, telescope, and all of the elephants were, of course, scattering, going as fast as they could after the matriarch. But he found that there were five elephants he could see in the distance that weren't rushing away, and he couldn't figure out that out. So he looked at them, and he found that the tall one in the middle was a male who had been wounded by the gunfire, and it was supported on either side by two females leaning inwards, because the males are a lot bigger than the females, and then being pushed from by two other females, which is an amazing story as well, that there should be such care for an animal that really they didn't know that well, because the males and the females really have separate societies.
Also, there's a story in the book that you tell about some elephants that were in trouble due to drought. And there was a young elephant who wasn't strong enough to get to the water source. And his or her mother laid down with him and refused to go to the water source. As a result, she died.
Yes. Droughts are terrible things for all animals, but for elephants particularly, because they range so widely hunting for forage. And then, of course, they have to drink each day as well. So if they eat the forage near any water source, they then have to walk, 10, 15 miles, which means that most of their day is spent either foraging and trying to find food and then going for water. And many die of drought.
Yeah.
And they say that's one of the good reasons that the matriarchs are so old. They have the memory of where there might be another water source that they could go to. And if they didn't live for such a long time, say 60 years, this wouldn't be remembered, and it wouldn't be a resource for the elephants.
Yeah. And that gets us to looking at human societies. In human societies, older individuals have been looked to for guidance, valued for their experience. So this is happening with other social animals then.
Yes. Oh, I think experience is incredibly important for this very reason. If you didn't have a water source, all the elephants might die of lack of water. But since an older animal, we remember, since the oldest animals are the matriarchs who keep growing as they get older, they can follow this female to another water source and perhaps the herd can be saved. I think that this would be true for human societies as well, having it until our modern era came. Of course, the old people were revered for having memories of how they succeeded in the past, of their culture, of the rituals.
Yeah. Now, within a group of elephants, a herd of elephants, is that kind of valuing of the older members, of the older matriarchs, is that something that's, we don't know, might that be something that is that they are conscious of?
The matriarch seems to run such a tight ship. She seems to be willing to push anyone aside if they're annoying to her or not doing what she thinks is right. So it's hard really to tell. I think really she is the one who commands respect and has respect of all the other animals, maybe just because she has had this vast experience.
You quote a fellow by the name of Fraser Darling at the close of the chapter, The Wisdom of Elders. He said, "The matriarchal system in animal life being selfless is a move toward the development of an ethical system." Is there evidence for acts of generosity, altruism between animals within families and communities?
Oh, among monkeys, there's huge literature of this. Monkeys giving things to their kin, letting their kin eat something when a non-kin isn't allowed to. And depending on the species, if it's a single male, some females living with a single male, then it's of course of value. But if they're two males, then they don't know whether their young are fathered, which one fathers them, so then they are less nepotistic because of this. It's a very interesting question that people are publishing about quite frequently just recently.
Yeah, because if you think about it, it seems to me that that's a really good question, and if we look at a social way of living, a social way of life, the hypothesis on my part would be that that might very well lead to the possibility of altruism.
Yeah, that's right. And if it is kin, of course, this, according to genetic theory, this means that your part of your genes are in your children, half of your genes are in your children, so you're benefiting them for this reason.
Yeah.
Which is an important part of evolution now as well.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Ann Inesadag is our guest this afternoon. She's the author of The Social Behavior of Older Animals. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a phone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener in Atlanta, Illinois, on line four. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
My husband and I were younger. We had a cow herd, and we went over one day to check the cows. What they had calves, and so we couldn't believe it. But we saw this coyote that was kind of sniffing around the calves, and all of a sudden, the cows, the mothers, got in a big circle, and they started moving in short, you know, closer and closer and closer to the coyote, and to protect their calves. And the fortunately or unfortunately, whatever, the coyote ducked under one of the cows and got away. But it was so amazing that instinct for all those cows to protect those calves.
Oh, that's
by
wonderful.
Doing that.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, it was just amazing. We just were awestruck because we were there at the right time and saw this, which was amazing.
And you could imagine the mother doing this, but to have all of them doing it is
it was,
is
they
really
got in a complete circle, and they just started moving closer and closer and closer to this coyote where their cat was with the calves.
Wow.
It was just unbelievable. So I thought I'd share that with you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. A great story. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and toll-free 800-222-9455. That story reminds me of some reportage you do in the book about spinner dolphins. They live so closely together.
Oh, isn't it claustrophobic?
Yeah. But on the other hand, it's really smart.
Right. It keeps them alive.
Yeah. Well, tell us about spinner dolphins. What are they? Where do they live? And why is it so important that they stick together?
The ones that are being most studied have been studied in Hawaii, and they live in large troops. They're about 150 pounds and quite thin, so that they aren't really big enough to go alone on the ocean because a shark could easily get one. So what they do is live in quite close groups. When they go out to feed, they spread out at night and to get fish. But then if there's a shark in the area, they immediately clump together again, travel very quickly, so closely together that the predator can't actually identify one individual to attack. So that really, by making this what's called a magic envelope, they're succeeding in being able to eat and feed in the ocean proper, and yet not be predated to any large extent. So, and their other why they're called spinner is that when they're feeding in the evening, they can't see each other. But what they do is leap into the air, spin around like a quad spinner, and fall into the water with a huge whack. And this lets other spinner dolphin in the group know where each of the individuals are, and so they can keep track of what individuals are doing even as they're feeding, which is really neat.
There's another mammal that lives in the water that's very interesting, pilot whales. And here you write about pilot whales in The Social Behavior of Older Animals and the grandmother hypothesis.
Oh, isn't that cool?
Yeah, that's really cool.
Well, as far as the short fin pilot whale, the study that brought this to light was done in Japan, and they had killed over 700 of these whales. And zoologists went in for each whale. They could age the whale from it by looking at its teeth, and they could check its reproductive condition. And what they found was that a quarter of all the females were no longer breeding, which means that they were, in effect, competing for resources with all the rest of the herd. So then they thought, well, how can that be? Because surely evolution would have knocked them off since they're just a drain on society. But the more the closer they looked at it, they found that these females actually were really important to the whole group, and they were lactating, producing milk long after they had stopped reproducing. When some of the young would go, some of the mothers would go down to get feed, to get food and fish at the deep in the ocean. They would babysit for the young and with milk keep them safe and protect them with themselves. So it was a case of grannies doing something to help the next generation without themselves breeding, because they were all beyond breeding age at that point, which was about 40. So they lived about 60, but there were a quarter of the population then wasn't breeding, but was doing this other useful service to the rest of the herd, which I thought was cool.
Yeah. And the animals that live in our oceans are difficult to study. What are some of the questions researchers are asking and trying to answer about animals like these, the whales?
Oh, there's so many. It's just so difficult. The right whale, for example, goes all the way from their north and south populations, all the way from the Antarctic or to the Arctic to the temperate zones or the tropical zones around, say, Argentina, which is where they've been studied. And they wonder why the old whales, the theory is why would they go there? Because most of the food is in the north and the south. And then a theory was that, well, that's because it's the water's too cold for the young when they're born. But then another theory is that perhaps they need the calm waters of the temperate areas, temperate waters, to learn how to breathe and to swim properly before they join the group and then go back to the north or south at the end of each season. So, but again, people have really no idea if that makes sense, but that's what they decide so far anyway.
Yeah. I saw something really remarkable some years ago off the coast of Canada, off the coast of New Brunswick. I'll never forget it. Right whales, a number of males courting a female.
Oh.
It was spectacular. And the fisherman who was our guide, he just turned the boat off, and we sat there, and there was this very gentle courting going on, and he told us that they would not mate at this time in that location, but they're merely courting, and she's going to figure out who she wants to, who she will mate with in warmer waters.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. It was incredible. So there's a courtship that goes on, and the mating comes much later.
Well, yeah, apparently there's a whole lot of sexual activity going on in the oceans. For example, dolphins, which we aren't really aware of, but dolphins apparently are often, I've read somewhere, one of the documents said that 30% of their time was spent rubbing each other. Sometimes they'd get their beak into the genital slit of another animal and push it along, or then they'd rub each other. Quite amazing, really.
Yeah. What do we know about life within a whale pod?
Very little,
not
really.
Not much.
No. A fair amount of research has been done on two. The sperm whales spin go maybe 35 or maybe 20,000 miles a year from one place to another. We don't know what attracts them, how they know where the vegetation bloom in the oceans are that they feed upon. There really is a huge vacuum, and a lot of time has been spent on this, really, but it's just very difficult to know. I mean, probably when you were watching them, you really couldn't have deciphered that for yourself.
No, and a lot of it was going on, you know, most of the whales, most of their bodies were underwater, of course. just part of their, you know, we were only seeing a fraction of the top of their bodies.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I would imagine, though, given that whales can have relatively long lives, that they face some of the same challenges that elephants do.
I'm sure they do. And one of the interesting things about both those populations is that they've been heavily harvested, so that we really don't even know what a normal population is of these big whales or the big elephants that have the most ivory. So, and from the Japanese, Norway, Iceland are still hunting whales to some extent illegally, and maybe we never will have any natural populations of these animals. So whatever we can find out, we don't know whether this is what it was originally, because we've lost this all the upper layer, all the oldest individuals, which is terrible, really.
Yeah, so that leaves one wondering, like the elephants, we saw the story of the rogue elephants in South Africa due to the fact that the older animals were the ones that were culled. One wonders, you know, how the loss of mature and older whales affect the others within the pod.
Yeah, exactly. And the thought is that they reduce reproduction, but again, this can't be well documented. It's just too difficult to find out what's going on.
Yeah. And one wonders if that kind of trauma affects one's ability to go, I'm making a really human kind of a connection here, but it wonders if that makes it more difficult to go on with their lives. I mean, we have, as humans, I think many of us have seen animals grieve.
Oh, yes. Yes, definitely. And elephants, I think, are to a huge extent. Like the ones that went by to pay tribute to the poor little elephant that was killed.
Oh.
And there are records of elephants having a companion die perhaps for heart attack, and they'll wait around for a few minutes, and then they'll realize the person's dead or the elephant's dead. They'll put vegetation on it, sort of like a burial, really, and then they'll slowly go away because they realize they can't do anything, and that's life, although they don't realize that's life.
Yeah. With age, bodies deteriorate, strength and fertility are lost. How does that affect the position of social animals within a group?
Well, by definition, I've decided that the older animals were all of those past their prime. So when I was describing them, I had the ones that were actually what's called reproductive senescence, meaning they're producing fewer young as they get old. But the interesting thing is that often an animal, or sometimes anyway, it's been documented that the final animal, the baby, will be born. It'll be bigger in weight than the younger animals are producing, and this is called reproductive terminal investment. Someone thought of this name. So that when an animal perhaps thinks, of course it wouldn't think, but when an animal is producing its last young, apparently it does sort of a last hurrah, and the young's born larger, mother spends more time giving it milk, more of herself, more resources, and presumably this will make the young more able to reach maturity, which is amazing.
Hmm. What happens, is there something similar that happens within males?
Yes, there is, actually. There's one example for moose, and what they did was weigh moose, and they found that the oldest moose weighed less after they had been killed. This was in Norway, actually. And they have a hunt that's really strictly controlled, and they found that the oldest ones had lost the most weight, and they correlated this with the activity that they had spent in the rut, finding females and mating with them. So it's a little bit circumspect, but they did conclude that there was terminal investment for a male moose as well when they got very old, which again is cool.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Anne Innes Dagg. She teaches in the Independent Studies Program of the University of Waterloo, Ontario. She's the author of more than a dozen books. We're talking with her this afternoon about her book, The Social Behavior of Older Animals. It's published by the Johns Hopkins Press. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The animals, social animals who are leaders, do they fare better in terms of how they age and how long they live than those who are subordinate to them?
Usually. There are some examples where it wasn't the case, but usually the more power you have as, say, an alpha male or an alpha female, the more likely you are to have young, the more likely you are to live longer. And one exception is mountain sheep, which apparently the alpha males are really active from about age 6 on, but then they tend to die sooner than the ones that aren't alpha, maybe beta or gamma, I guess. So you can't say for sure, but it does seem so that there's an advantage in being dominant usually.
How do subordinates fare as they grow old? Are they subject still to the same kind of position as they've been in throughout their lives?
Yes, they just hang on, I guess. And some of them, if they can live long enough, they can actually produce more than the alpha males that tend to die young from overexertion. And that's the case in some. The example I give in the book is of a pronghorn antelope who was very subordinate, but managed to hang on and produce. She produces twins every single year, and the twins together weighed 8 pounds each, which would be like us producing a 19-pound baby, if you can imagine, every year. Just an amazing species. And the animals that are dominant are the ones that are born earliest, so that the infant, the heavier it is, the sooner it's born, the more it is dominant, and then it remains dominant throughout its life, so that the ones that are born later are always subordinate and have a less chance of making the best of everything. Yeah. So that would be one example.
At the end of life, does social position matter?
No, I don't think so. They've done their best.
Let's take another call. A listener on line two, I think we have a call ready to go, in McLean, Illinois. Good afternoon, line two.
Good afternoon. I have a comment and then kind of like an open question. The comment is, when we as human beings use modeling as a teaching tool for children, why is imitating an animal not considered a teaching tool? That's a general open question. It's really more like a comment. I think it should be. And number two is, for many years, humans believed that animals couldn't feel. Now that we're finding out or at least we experience that they feel, how about the fact that maybe they also think? Because sometimes I've heard people say, well, animals can't think and decide for themselves or organize their thoughts and make decisions. It isn't all instinct. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Oh, well, yes, I agree. I agree entirely. There have been a number of books published by a man called Franz de Waal, who has shown that chimpanzees and baboon societies have a tremendous amount of thinking going on. They join other ones to fight against alpha male, make alliances to do all sorts of things. I think they're thinking all the time, really. There was one animal that was losing his alphadom because he was becoming older, and whenever he was nervous, he'd have a tantrum, and then people would come chimpanzees would come around him, and then together they would maybe support him to fight the person that had, or the chimpanzee that had brought him grief. So really, they're thinking all the time, I think, and they certainly have senses probably similar to our own.
Yeah. So it seems that in that little story that you told, there are animals comforting another.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Sometimes they didn't, of course, and then you'd have even more of a tantrum.
Well, you know, that raises the question, what are the ethical implications for us as human animals here?
From
looking at now, we're talking about animals as teachers, animals as comforters, animals grieving, animals being traumatized. Where do we go with this information in terms of how we treat animals?
Oh, I just hope we start to do something about factory animals and especially factory animals and chickens kept in small cages. If you know they're sentient, you know they feel grief, you know they, as we know from facts brought out in the research that I cite in the book, we know this, so that it's really terrible that we're not doing more about domestic animals, which I think we should have a real push in this area right now.
Again, this is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest, Ann Innes Dagg, author most recently of The Social Behavior of Older Animals. We have about 5 minutes left in this portion of the program, so listeners, if you'd like to call in with a question or a comment, we'll get you in. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Veterinarians who care for companion animals have cat patients that are pushing 20 and dogs well into their teens. Is care for geriatric animals something that students in the field of veterinary medicine studying today? And what does this tell us about the need for taking care of the social needs of animals?
Well, there certainly are. I think they are really more and more interested in looking after companion animals, and because actually that's where a large part of their money comes from, people with animals that are getting old and sick. And sometimes they're stressed because they don't know whether they should try and keep the animal alive. This stresses the partner or the person that lives with the animals, the companion, whether what should they do? Should they put the animal down? Mm. Should they have it fixed? I think the vets are really good with this at present. As far as domestic animals go, of course, that there's no information on what happens to them when they get old, because they never do get old, so that all the textbooks just stop when they reach their prime, and that's when they're turned into food, I guess.
Hmm. Let's take another call. A listener in Farmer City, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
I know that this, we don't have a whole lot of time, but it seems to me like an awful lot of the discussion is centered around older animals passing along life experiences and survival skills to the younger ones. And earlier there was a little bit of discussion about what teaching meant. I'm wondering if you used a looser definition of teaching in your book, or you know, how you related this subject. I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, we did look at teaching briefly, and I think the teaching that people would like to use is one that they know the teacher knows that he or she has more information than the person being taught, and therefore has a theory of mind for the other individual. But this, of course, is probably not known, not present actually in most animals. Mm. So that would be one sticking point. I think that would be the main one. And some zoologists do think they do teach, and if not on purpose, but then by doing activities that the other animals see and then can imitate.
Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana, line two. Good afternoon.
Yes, back to the topic of teaching.
Uh-huh.
Anyone who's observed farm cats, watched a mother cat training her kittens, they will begin by bringing back a dead mouse and feeding it to the kittens. And then they start bringing back live mice or game. And obviously what they're doing is teaching the animal, the kittens, how to catch game. And it's my observation that a kitten that's raised, from 6 weeks or whatever, in a home without a mother cat, often will not have any recognition of a mouse as a prey animal.
I agree with you 100%, actually. I think that is actually true. But there is a group of people that still think that animals don't teach. They think that the mother brings the... It's an inborn behavior to bring a dead mouse, and it's then when the animal gets older, it's an inborn behavior for it to bring a live mouse, so that it's completely into her heredity, and the young obviously act into it. I don't know how we'd ever prove that was or was not true, but that's what perhaps the leading people think nowadays, that it's not actually teaching; it's just something that the mother does, which is bred in her.
Would be that. Kitten that's raised away from its mother usually doesn't teach its kittens.
I agree with you, actually.
And there's obviously, if it were genetic, I guess you could set this up if you wanted. Remove one kitten from a litter and raise it away from the litter, and then raise other kittens with the litter, and see if there's a difference in the teaching behaviors of the animals. It seems to me that there's a great resistance on the part of people to admit the similarity of humans. There's a the argument that man learned to speak, oh, some have been ridiculous enough to say 10,000 years ago or later. I would guess that communication exists in all forms of organisms, and that speech itself is simply a development of this, and that probably all higher animals have some kind of high-level communication, not sentence and paragraph-based or anything of that sort, but the ability to communicate sometimes vocally and sometimes with gesture. Remember, what is it, 70% of human communication is non-vocal?
And there's been a lot of study to complete your point. In prairie dogs, for example, if a hawk comes over, then the animals have a certain cry so that they know when to run into their holes. And if it's a coyote that comes by, there's another cry. I mean, this is obviously communication, and it can be quite sophisticated, really. It's most interesting.
Yeah, and in our lives with cats and dogs, certainly we see a lot of body language.
Oh, yes.
with our interaction with them and with their interaction with other animals.
Yes, to say a dog, to get your dog to go on a walk, you know exactly what it's feeling.
Yeah. There we'll wrap up. It's been really wonderful speaking with you this afternoon. What a wonderful topic. The social behavior of older animals. Ann Innes Dagg, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Ann Innes Dagg has been our guest this afternoon here in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of The Social Behavior of Older Animals. The book is published by the Johns Hopkins Press.